When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. Don't forget, coming up on tomorrow's episode, we're going to be hearing from Allegra Stratton, the Prime Minister's COP26 spokesperson, answering your questions. You've just got time to get your questions in. You can email me, matt.chorley@times.radio, whatever questions you've got about the COP26 talks themselves, about the global challenge of tackling climate change, but also what it might mean for you and your family. You can email me, matt.chorley@times.radio, and we'll put your question to Allegra Stratton tomorrow. Right, coming up on today's episode is Happy Birthday to Private Eye, 60 years old. There's a new book out chronicling six decades of both reporting the news and, I'll be honest, taking the mickey out of it. I'll speak to the author, Adam McQueen, about that. First, though, it's Monday, so it must be Libby Rachie. It's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. Now then, let's talk about the budget. Obviously, the budget coming up on Wednesday. A phenomenal, something like £30 billion has already been announced from Rishi Sunak. Not all of it new, it has to be said. Let's focus in particular on the NHS and even more money being announced for dealing with NHS backlogs. Libby, is there ever going to be enough? Is it ever enough money for the NHS, do you think?
Never will there be quite a magic bullet, and there's a lot of reorganisation needed. But what I think was interesting, I did not hear him mention nurses, and the nurse shortage is very serious. I've just had a friend whose brain surgery was cancelled and post-dated sort of three or four times, simply because there was a bed, there was an anaesthetist, there was a surgeon, but there weren't enough nurses waiting in case he needed an ITU bed. And I think that's one interesting thing. I'd like to hear more about nurses. And also, I do think I'm getting a sense that the extreme advice to keep the hell away from doctors and hospitals during the first long lockdown is now seen as a mistake. There's quite a lot of the NHS is there for you, because there are still people not taking important symptoms in, it seems, out of fear, because we were told so strongly to keep away from doctors in the first lockdown. So I think that needs thinking about too.
What do you think, Rachel? Because I suppose part of the trouble is Libby says, you can announce all this money, but unless it takes time to train doctors and nurses to do this stuff to bring down the waiting list.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the politics of this are really fascinating, because the Conservatives have decided they can't be on the other side of the public on the NHS. The NHS is incredibly popular. They have to be seen to be supporting the NHS, particularly now, as you know, during the COVID crisis. But there is a huge problem with staff shortages, as Libby mentions, in nurses, but also in social care. And Boris Johnson talks about, you know, we've got to have a high wage economy, but actually some of the lowest wages are in social care. And that's the sort of government's responsibility to deal with that. And the other thing that I think is fascinating on the politics is that, you know, despite all this money for the NHS, at the same time, we've got this growing COVID crisis coming up again on the tracks, and the government's giving these really confused mixed messages. It's refusing to go to what it calls its plan B. It won't even say we should all wear masks or MPs should wear masks in the House of Commons. And there is this kind of, it's all very well throwing money, but if then you don't deal with the actual immediate crisis, the NHS is just going to be overwhelmed in the short term in any case. So there's a kind of confused picture there, I think, politically.
I suppose of all the political risks that Boris Johnson faces approaching the 2023 or 2024 general election, Libby, having long waiting lists, 1990s style long waiting lists in the NHS, is probably about as bad as it could get for Boris Johnson. So, I mean, I can understand why they're throwing loads of money at it, but there's just a question. Ultimately, the question is whether or not he can deliver. And this is not necessarily an administration renowned for turning promises into action.
Organisation and determination and just getting the right people to consult with and to make the right decisions. I mean, we saw this in the brilliant vaccination, administration, where Kate Bingham just really got going among experts and said, yes, this, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll this, we'll take a risk on this, we won't take a risk on this, we'll do that. And that is what this government is not good at. He has not surrounded himself with that kind of brilliant organisationally minded people. I think probably the Chancellor is the nearest to it. I think that is what we need, and we need a health secretary. I mean, I have some hopes of Javid because I think he's very, very bright. But, I mean, we suffered terribly under Jeremy Hunt, who obviously sort of went on and on, he now goes on and on about how marvellous everything would have been if he'd been in charge and, how everyone's doing everything wrong, without even mentioning the fact that when he was health secretary, intensive care beds were cut by many. And ran down the PPE stocks. All these things have happened in the past, and we need to look at proper forward planning, which I think may bring us on to the wonderful piece about Finland, which I'm very excited by.
Yes, well, let's talk about Finland in that case then. Our colleague Edward Lucas, writing in the Times, saying what we can learn from Finland. What can we learn from Finland apart from Father Christmas?
It's way more than Father Christmas. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful sort of list of things they've done, many of which are to do exactly with this business of planning, planning and bringing all sorts of senior people and managers in the community, not just for military defence, but for disaster planning. The great thing for creating aviation fuel out of old food rubbish and the rest. It's just so impressive, this sense of a small country just really getting its nose down and trying to organise and to plan and to be aware that there will always be emergencies and that we should be ready for them. We have been shockingly bad at that the last few years.
Why do you think that is, Rachel? You spent a long time seeing Westminster and politicians up close. Why are we bad at planning? Why are we worse at planning than Finland, of all places?
Well, I think the interesting thing, I've just actually come back from Estonia, next to Finland, which has copied a lot or learnt a lot from Finland. I was there looking at the education system for the Education Commission, and there are big similarities between their education systems. They start school later, not until 7. They have a big focus on early years, before children even get to school, making sure that they're ready for learning. But I think the thing that's the characteristic that they have and we don't is it's very pragmatic, it's unideological, they're willing to sort of admit mistakes of the past. They're not caught up on their own, banging their own drum as we're the world beating, we're the best, we've got this great history, we've got this great empire, this imperial past. They just get on with, they look at the evidence and they decide what's going to work. So, for example, in the Finland case, they have, they've gone for nuclear power, and the environmentalists are backing that. So on whether it's on left or right, it's not so ideological. They're looking at the evidence, and it's the same in Estonia with the school system. They're looking at the evidence. They've got a sort of cross-party strategy, talking of planning, until 2035 for education. It's unimaginable that we'd have that here, because there'd be somebody rowing about statues or, the curriculum and which authors should be on the list of approved novels for GCSEs. And there's that sort of, it's a pragmatic, apolitical, unideological approach, which I think allows them to plan.
And this isn't just, I mean, this isn't just a sort of Boris Johnson government problem, is it? It's the whole of British politics, Libby. That if Boris Johnson to stand up and set out, well, we tried this thing, that didn't quite work, but we're going to have a go at this thing, the entire, you know, the opposition would be all over. Oh, you admit you've made a dog's breakfast of this. It'd be all over the front pages. U-turn. And that's why it doesn't happen. That's why that sort of honesty in politics just doesn't happen.
Indeed. And in another wonderful bit of the piece about Finland, apparently the children at school from earliest years are taught media literacy. They're taught to consider the fact that something might be a hoax, that something might be a lie, that something might not be supported by evidence. And I think we could do with some of that too at every level. I mean, if you think of the people, I mean, my brother, who's a hospital, you know, he works in a hospital, is absolutely enraged by one of his colleagues at the moment who's a vaccine refuser and is going around saying, well, I've been on the web, you know, and I've been on the dark web as well, and I know best, you know, these vaccines are all poisonous. You know, early years, a sense of weighing up evidence and realizing that somebody might be hoaxing you. I mean, that sounds like a wonderful bit of the education system in Finland.
Mm. And it's very similar in Estonia. They have this approach of, we're going to teach children to have curiosity, creativity. They're not seen as dirty words. Challenge things that they're told. Think it through. It's a much more kind of creative and inclusive and holistic approach to education, rather than just learning lots and lots of facts to churn them out for an exam.
But while we're putting fixing the British political system, let's also fix the honest system. Claire Foges writing in the Times today. I mean, she's been the beneficiary of this. She used to be David Cameron's speechwriter. She's got an OBE, which is actually quite good because almost everyone had ever met her. I think I was the only person who'd ever met David Cameron who didn't get an MBE when he left Number 10. But the weirdest, latest development is because I think Tony Blair started this. Tony Blair didn't take an honour. He's not taken a seat in the House of Lords. Therefore, Gordon Brown, David Cameron and Theresa May haven't. So Philip May, Theresa May's husband, has got a knighthood instead, which just seems very strange. Dennis Thatcher obviously got a knighthood too, but Margaret Thatcher would go into the House of Lords. What do you make of this, Rachel?
Well, Claire is very anti all of this, and she thinks there needs to be a big reform of the honours system. I'm more worried about peerages, which Claire doesn't seem so worried about. I think, in a way, the honours system, yes, it's anachronistic, yes, it's old-fashioned, yes, why on earth should Philip May get an honour at one level? And I remember Theresa May, in fact, she told her aides right at the beginning, you'll be lucky if you get a Jaffa cake, you know, I'm not going to give any honours. And then she handed them out like sweeties at the end as well. But an honour, it doesn't give you any power, doesn't give you any influence. Whereas a peerage, you get to vote on the laws of the country, you get to decide, you know, how we're governed. And I think that's far more pernicious when you have political donors actually having power in that way, or party, you know, apparatchiks. I think that's far worse than an honour, which actually is irrelevant at one level. You know, if somebody wants an honour, you know, fine, it doesn't really make any, there's no skin off the rest of our noses.
I suppose it's essentially a pat on the head. It's a gold star for the teacher.
It's a gold star, but it doesn't actually give any power at all. Whereas a peerage, that really is pernicious.
Yeah. Libby, what do you think? Or Dame Libby, surely it's only a matter of time.
MBE.
Certainly not. Only in the panto sense. I mean, I have to say, I love what Claire said, the fact that she got an OBE for just doing her job she was paid for David Cameron, whereas her mother got an MBE, which is technically a level lower, for years and years and years of being a foster mother. I mean, when you do go to one of these ceremonies, and I did, I went and got my OBE simply because the children wanted to go to the palace, you know, that's most people say that. But you sit there and you listen to the citations of people who've done astonishing, unsung, humble, useful work for years, and you think, yeah, that's what it's all about. I like the honours system because I think all the faradiddle and, you know, medals and palace and so on actually is a good reward for people who have done that kind of work, like Claire's mother. But I think the business of getting it just because you do your job is absurd, you know. And I mean, that my father got a CMG because that was the level in the Foreign Office he'd risen to as a diplomat, but, you know, he always thought it was a bit of nonsense. So I think it needs looking at. I do like the idea of replacing the word empire with excellence, because I think the word empire is just getting so embarrassing now that nobody can go around with a medal with an empire on it. So I think what Claire says on the whole is fine, but also what Rachel says about peerages. I mean, good grief. Who is it? Dennis Thatcher got a baronetcy. I think Mark Thatcher presumably gets that.
Libby Purves and Rachel Sylvester there. Of course, you can read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's Happy Birthday, Private Eye.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast now. It's time for this. This is the sound of six decades in music. And this year, the beloved satirical political magazine Private Eye turns 60. It's an absolutely cracking book. There's an absolutely cracking book out, Private Eye, the 60-year book. Six decades of jokes and journalism. Edited by Adam McQueen. And Adam joins me now. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Matt. Nice to be here.
It's nice to have you.
I was thinking I ought to try and identify every piece of music there. You want to quiz me on them.
No, I'm not going to. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that on the music front. So in a moment, we're going to rattle through every decade in about 4 minutes in a sec. We'll play some music for me. But more broadly, explain the book, because it's not the history of Private Eye, but it's a sort of history as told by Private Eye.
It is. So for the 50th anniversary, we did Private Eye's History of Private Eye. So we've done that one, and we decided for the 60th, what we ought to do is a thing that we've never done. We always do an annual every year of kind of the best of the jokes from each year. And we thought, why not do that for the entire 60 years? This is basically Private Eye's history of the entire world and everything that's happened, all the big historical, political, cultural events of the last six decades, exactly as they were seen in the pages of Private Eye. So through all those features people remember, like Dear Bill, Mrs. Wilson's Diary, the Nursery Times, things like that, the best of the cartoons as well. So absolutely everything crammed into 320 pages from the last six decades.
And there's a brilliant sort of instruction at the very beginning of the book where it basically says, just to explain what's going on, there are jokes and there are journalism. The jokes have a white background. The journalism has a sort of yellow background, just so you can tell the difference.
Yeah, people do have difficulty telling the difference sometimes.
There is a little bit of that. And just how did you reread every single edition of Private Eye, or did you just go back to the annuals? How did you go about tackling a
back. We have a set of bound copies of all. Where are we at now? The one that is, we're actually going to press today with issue number 1559, and I have read all 1558 copies. I've pored over them. We have bound editions in the office, and when lockdown was announced back in whenever it was, February 2020, I went home with all of the bound editions in the back of my car and spent most of lockdown poring over every single edition of Private Eye ever published. My eyesight is now considerably worse. I have much much stronger glasses than I had to have at the beginning of all this.
Lovely stuff. So that's the background to it. Well, let's do this. Let's do it decade by decade. We kick off with the 1960s. So Adam, talk me through how Private Eye came about. And the thing that really struck me looking at it is that it looks, some of the front pages, some of the logo slightly changed, but the tone, the voice is almost exactly the same to how it is today.
It gets there right from the beginning. And part of the reason for that is the consistency in the staff of Private Eye. So the very first edition, which did look rather different, but it was basically put together by Christopher Booker and by Willie Rushton. And they were helped out a bit by John Wells and Richard Ingrams. Now, all four of those people stayed with the Eye and were associated with the Eye right through their lives. Richard Ingrams, fortunately, is still with us. The other three sadly aren't anymore. But certainly Christopher Booker, who was the very first editor, despite being sacked in 1963, so not lasting very long as editor, came back and remained part of the joke writing team right up until his death a couple of years ago. So there has been that sort of consistency of people and consistency of tone, like you say. It looked very different. The first edition, apart from anything else, was printed on bright yellow paper for some reason, because I think that Peter Usborne, the first business manager, managed to source a load of yellow paper from somewhere. And he was pushing at the time for it to be called the Yellow Press rather than Private Eye, which I'm not done whether that one will last. I don't know. But it's entirely illustrated by Willie Rushton. It's got no photos at all. And the famous photo bubble cover, which is the thing that most people think of when they think of Private Eye, didn't come in until a bit later on in the next year at the suggestion of Peter Cook, who had ripped off the idea from a magazine called Help, which he saw in New York when he was touring over there with Beyond the Fringe, which turned out to actually be the idea of Terry Gilliam, who was later in Monty Python. That was his idea that we ripped off from him. Terry Gilliam later on said that he came round to the Eye office with various cartoons that he'd done, and we didn't take a single one of them, so he really didn't do very well out of it.
So, yeah, so in 1962, the story is that Prince Charles was rushed to hospital from his prep school for an emergency appendectomy. And the first ever speech bubble is a sort of coach and horses, full royal coach and horses, with a speech bubble saying, "Great Ormond Street, James, and step on it." But yes. Actually, then by like 1963, the front of Private Eye looks like it does now. The logo's the same, the speech bubbles are the same, and it's had this
enormous...
It's all
there, isn't it? Yeah.
And why do you think it took... I mean, it obviously had a very checkered history in terms of, you know, finances and staffing and that sort of thing. But why do you think it took hold? Was it that it was part of that sort of satire boom that it managed to latch onto?
Well, it certainly was part of that. I mean, that was an enormous thing. And you had the Profumo scandal in 1963. And that was the week that was on television, which essentially just lifted the entire staff of Private Eye and installed them as scriptwriters to David Frost. It was sort of wholesale lifting of the whole thing. So that was enormous. And at that point, the readership of Private Eye rocketed up and everyone wanted to be sort of irreverent and satirical and all this kind of thing. But that's a really, really small part of the history. That was basically all over by 1964. I actually found yesterday when I was going through various papers, this is an appeal for funds from 1964, because basically the whole thing crashed after the satire boom was kind of finished. And this was this is a thing written by the then business manager that saying it became a spectacular success with circulation soaring to over 80,000 at one point at the height of the Profumo affair. A lot of people thought it was a brilliant freak, a flash in the pan. And to no one's surprise, when the satire boom lost fashionability, when Harold Macmillan retired, when Christine Keeler went to jail and TW3 was extinguished, circulation during the autumn of 63 began to slip quickly down again. And this is basically a thing like, please invest some money in it. Now, luckily at that point, Peter Cook arrived back from America and did invest some money with us. Not only that, but he installed a lot of other kind of groovy 60s celebrities as shareholders in Private Eye, where they remain to this day. So Jane Asher has shares in Private Eye. Dirk Bogarde also bought a chunk of Private Eye, which has gone down through his family. Jane Asher, amazingly, met her husband, Gerald Scarfe, at a Private Eye party. And they remain together now. So that's done quite well out of that investment, certainly. But yeah, it just sort of went on. It built up. I mean, they're talking then about a circulation of 80,000 being incredible. These days, when print is supposedly dead, 50-something years on, we're at an average of 239,000 copies every fortnight. So, it wasn't just that boom.
And how that happened. Let's move on then to the 1970s. I mean, I basically never miss an opportunity to play Elton John on this show, which
enough.
Is a perfectly good one. So this is the 1970s and Crocodile Rock. So you're sort of ahead of the 1970s. By this point, it's reasonably established, 10 years in. It's got, you know, it clearly, it's got its tone of voice and that sort of thing. But the thing that struck me is that the sort of the journalism starts playing a bigger and bigger part in it as well by the 70s.
Yeah, that's the other essential ingredient of Private Eye. The cartoons are there right from the beginning. The satire and the spoofs are there right from the beginning. The journalism comes in a bit later, and it comes on first of all in the form of a guy called Claude Coburn, who by that point was a very, very old man. He was famous for a magazine he ran in the 1930s called The Week, which exposed the Clifton set and various kind of appeasers of Hitler and things like that. You know, this is how kind of old school he was. But shortly after he comes in, you get two other really, really key figures who come in. One is Paul Foot, who was the absolute kind of doyen of investigative journalists. And he's involved for the whole of his life, right through to 2004 when he died. I was lucky enough to work with him. It was absolutely incredible. He really did set the tone for the kind of investigative stuff and the miscarriages of justice that Private Eye has burrowed into over the years and pursued for decades at the time. And the other essential ingredient at the back of the magazine is Michael Gillard, who is Slicker, who runs our In the City pages, which are this kind of really forensic, hard-hitting investigation of business and various con men through the ages. So you've kind of got that, and it's this weird formula that you get. No one would ever pitch this now. No one would ever say, we're going to do a magazine that's going to have some really hard-hitting investigative stuff, which is going to cause lots of legal problems. You're going to get lots of injunctions and writs and all sorts of stuff like that. We're going to go some really hardcore sort of miscarriages of justice, which will be quite hard reading, and a lot of those campaigns are going to go on for years. Also, we're going to have a load of really tasteless jokes in the middle that readers will get offended over and constantly keep cancelling their subscriptions. Occasionally, the cover will be so offensive and cause so much offence it'll actually be ripped off the shelves in newsagents and people will refuse to sell it. Oh, and a load of cartoons as well, and maybe a bit of architecture and a farming column too. I mean, it's just sort of this mad
there's something for everyone
that's grown everyone. Over time, but it works somehow.
You mentioned legal actions, and this is something that again is dogged Private Eye over the year. I suppose if you're not doing your job properly, if you don't occasionally get threatened with being sued, but James Goldsmith in particular tried to sue the Eye out of business on behalf of Harold Wilson, the then Prime Minister.
Yes, yeah. Well, it was partly on behalf of Harold Wilson. It was partly out of his own complete madness. He was convinced that there was this communist plot in the media, which Private Eye was an absolutely central part of. He talked about it, a septic pus in the media that had to be extinguished. But also it emerged afterwards that he was doing a lot of this on behalf of his great mates, Harold Wilson and Marcia Williams, Lady Falconer, as Harold Wilson made her, who was his kind of all-powerful sidekick in Number 10. And they had become so paranoid about stuff being leaked to Private Eye that they were absolutely determined to stamp the thing out of business. And it's in the records of various Wilson aides, the diaries of them, rather, that James Goldsmith put up an awful lot of money. You know, he was a multimillionaire at this point and a great gambler, in order to just really crush Private Eye out of business. It was something like 100 writs. And at one point, he was suing not only Private Eye itself, but all of the printers, the distributors, even sort of individual newsagents who were selling copies of the magazine to stop them selling it. And it turned out, actually, because he had such an enormous business empire, that I don't think he was entirely sure what it consisted of himself. He was actually suing several newsagent chains that he actually owned himself. That's how determined he was to crush us. But it didn't work. And it didn't work a decade later when another bully businessman and this time a very, very major crook, Robert Maxwell, tried to do the same thing.
Which brings us on perfectly to the 1980s. Yeah, we're still focusing on the legal side of things here, Adam McQueen. So Robert Maxwell, no friend of Private Eye.
Certainly not a friend of Private Eye. I think the problem with Robert Maxwell was that he lacked a sense of humour. And one of the real saving graces and things that's helped Private along the way is that you have to have a sense of humour. You have to show this sort of British sense of humour. There's some wonderful footage of Mrs. Thatcher and Dennis Thatcher going to to Anyone for Dennis, which was the kind of West End play version of Dear Bill, the long-running feature we had of Dennis Thatcher writing letters to his golfing partner. And for some, basically, they were taken along by their spin doctors because they wanted to show that Margaret Thatcher was a good sport, which, I mean, she was many, many things, but I don't think she was really. And she certainly didn't have a sense of humour. And there's this footage, you can find it on YouTube, of her literally talking through gritted teeth and saying, "Marvellous farce." And she obviously hated absolutely every second of it. Robert Maxwell was a bit the same. He was the first person ever to sue over a cartoon. He sued over jokes pieces, you know, all the things that you should just brush off and go, "Oh, yes, very, very funny. It's you're just taking the mickey." But he was absolutely, just had no sense of humour about it whatsoever, which doesn't make you popular with readers. And in the end, Maxwell sued so many times and won so many cases because that was the way that libel laws worked in the 1980s, that even if what you were saying was true, and we were saying things like, he's taking loads and loads of money out of the pension fund and ripping off all of his workers, which were entirely true. But, you know, had he not dropped off his yacht before he could actually serve the writ on us, he would have almost certainly have won that libel case too. He took so much money off us that we had to throw ourselves on the mercy of readers and launch a fund for them. And at that point, the readers who are incredibly loyal and have been throughout their time were quite willing to stump up because they didn't want to see us being put out of business by a bully like Captain Bob.
It was also in the 1980s that Ian Hislop became editor. And I suppose that's the thing. When you talk about the consistency of tone and look, it's partly because it's had so few editors. Ian Hislop, yes.
35 years this week as editor. I think that makes him the longest serving editor anywhere on anywhere in the country, probably certainly for a very, very long time. Yeah, it has. I mean, it is interesting as you go back through the back issues how much it has evolved, because people have this idea that it hasn't changed at all. But if you actually go back to Private Eye of the 70s and early 80s, it's being dominated by some really unlikely people. So Nigel Dempster, who, you know, was writing this sort of society diary for the Daily Mail in his later years, was kind of one of the major contributors in the 1970s. Peter Mackay, who also wrote for the Daily Mail, and Bron Ward wrote this absolutely brilliant fictionalized diary, which was all about him sort of going to have tea with the Queen and on all sorts of nonsense like that. It was fantastic, but it was a very, very different tone to the kind of the one that's been brought in later. It has changed a lot over the years.
We're talking 60 years of Private Eye, six decades of jokes in journalism. It's a new book by Adam McQueen. Now then, Adam, we've reached the 90s.
Yes.
We could pick for the 90s. And this was a point where the Eye ended up with its lowest circulation. Because I suppose that after the giddy heights of Margaret Thatcher, Dennis Thatcher, the unravelling of John Major's government, that presumably was boom time. But then what happens with Tony Blair? And then Tony Blair becomes Prime Minister, and then shortly afterwards, Princess Diana dies, which is also a slightly tricky time for the Eye.
Yeah, it was an odd time. So that's two events from 1907. The other one is that this is where I actually come into the story personally, because I joined on work experience in September 1997. And it was a really, really odd time because, and this will be very, very hard for a lot of your listeners to believe now, but Tony Blair was incredibly popular. People actually took that song literally. They did think things could only get better. And there was this weird sort of disillusionment. A similar thing actually happened back in the 60s, after that satire boom, and when Harold Wilson came in. I remember Richard Ingram's telling me about this, that suddenly people kind of went, oh, hang on, you're having a go at Labour. You're having a go at the ones who've come in and knew it, exciting, and we like them. And people didn't want to read it for a while. It didn't last for very long, I have to say. So Tony Blair took not that long to get embroiled in all sorts of scandals. Like, do you remember the Bernie Eccleston tobacco donation at the end of 97? And then, of course, you go into sort of the war on terror and and 45 minutes to doom and him taking a war in Iraq. And suddenly he's the Tony Blair we all know and loathe now. Yeah, it was a very, very odd time. And it wasn't helped by very odd national mood, which, again, is one of those things that seems slightly inexplicable now, after the death of Princess Diana. It was one of those occasions where the cover, which was an odd thing. It was meant to be, it wasn't in any way disrespectful of Princess Diana. It was meant to be pointing out that the newspapers who had been employing those paparazzos who had been pursuing her in the tunnel at the time of her death, and indeed the readers who'd been buying all those tabloids in record numbers over the summer to get those pictures, might bear some sort of responsibility and culpability in what had happened. Which, actually, looking back on it, is quite an odd thing, isn't it, to attack your readers on your cover? And maybe that was part of the reason it didn't go down well. But yeah, no, that issue was taken off shelves in newsagents across the country. And we got. I remember arriving on my work experience not long after that. And literally, in those days, we used to actually get letters from people. And I literally sacks of letters. It was like a cartoon itself. And the postman hauling them in of just people abusing us and saying how terrible we were. And actually quite a few sacks of letters of people saying, actually, I think you've got it right. Everyone else seems to have gone a bit potty at the time. But that cover, which was being taken off the shelves as being too offensive, was there at the same time as the very same day, in fact, it came out as the Sun front page that said, where is our queen? Where is her flag? to which the answer, if you remember, was at Balmoral with her grieving grandchildren. So it's quite weird to put those side by side now and think, hang on, which of those was considered offensive at the time?
I noticed that, just looking in the book, that Diana Funk cover's not in the book. Was that a deliberate choice?
It's been reproduced so many times in other places that we decided to pull out some of it. So there is a double page spread of the stuff from that Diana issue, because everyone remembers the cover. That was one of the things I wanted to do, was not to necessarily pick up all of those covers that people remember and that have been reproduced elsewhere, but try and kind of dig into the issues and get some other stuff in there. There is, I should say, for those of you, I mean, everyone should go out and stump up £30 for this book, because it is fantastic. There you are, I've got my plug in. But one of the other things you can do for free is go to the Private Eye website, where we have an entire library of every single cover, all 1,558 of them, which is you will lose a day or more to browsing through that. It is great fun.
I should point out, it is an absolutely cracking book. It's also a monster book. I mean, some books, you know, are fine for swatting a fly. I think you could probably do a mouse in with this. It's such a great big solid piece of work. Right, we'll move on then. We enter the new century, the new millennium. We enter the noughties.
1, 2, 3.
This is basically my whole Spotify playlist. Right, so Adam, we enter a new millennium, but Private Eye getting a reputation for particularly more of those. More of those stories from the back of the magazine, the proper journalism. Sometimes it would take years before other more mainstream publications noticed, but things like PFI, you know, tax deals for corporations, that sort of stuff, that really starts getting onto the front pages and the top of the news bulletins, the stuff that Private Eye been banging away at for a long time.
Yeah, it did. It took us 40 years, but suddenly we started being taken seriously and people actually noticing stuff. So the one that really struck me when I was putting this book together, there's this public inquiry going on at the moment into the contaminated blood scandal, which involved lots of haemophiliacs in the early and mid 1980s being injected, being given blood donations that were contaminated with HIV and hepatitis. It's taken that long. It's taken all those decades to get to a public inquiry. The very first piece that Private Eye wrote about it, it was Paul Foote that wrote it, was in 1987. So this is how long things take. And things like the Lockerbie scandal, I mean, Paul was onto that, and whether the right people were being pursued, or whether sort of realpolitik had got in the way and the investigation was going off in the direction of Libya when it should have been elsewhere. So within a couple of weeks of that flight being blown up back in the late 80s. So yeah, it does take an awfully long time. And one of the nicest things I found in the book was a quote from Margaret Hodge MP when she was chair of the Public Accounts Committee, basically saying, why am I getting all of my evidence, which I'm putting to people from HMRC, from the back pages of Private Eye? Why is this where it's coming from? And it's because we've got some excellent journalists who do some excellent stuff, basically. So, yeah, we start setting an agenda, which is nice.
But also, crucially, getting it from the back pages, because almost nothing goes online. You defy... Well, everyone else was rushing, you know, some people point out, actually the Times is quite sensible, they put up a paywall, which lots of other people are sort of following the lead on now. But Private Eye didn't even do that. If you wanted to read in full what was in the magazine, you had to buy the magazine.
Well, we've always had this attitude, I think, the editor certainly has, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So, I mean, technologically, we have always been decades, if not centuries behind. I mean, when I joined in 1997, the magazine was literally being put together with Ian Hislop moving little bits of paper around on a table until he had them in a position he was happy with, at which point they were kind of carried across the studio. And if anyone sort of opened a door or a window, they'd just blow away like confetti and we'd have to start the whole page again. And eventually the whole thing was stuck down with cow gum. The only reason they stopped doing this as the means of production was because cow gum was discovered to be highly carcinogenic and we were banned from using it at that point. But I mean, we were kind of one step on from the whole thing being copied out by monks doing lovely illuminated capital letters on the top of the pages. Weirdly, I mean, now we've gone extremely high tech because obviously with coronavirus, none of us could work from the office. And suddenly we've entered the 21st century, which is quite extraordinary. But no, I mean, online, there was a cartoon which the eye ran. I can't remember whether it's in the book or not, but in the late 90s, which is a meeting in a newspaper office. And the online team are saying, congratulations, guys, we're now our own biggest competitor. And that effectively is what people why buy a newspaper if you're going to start giving away everything online? That was the question that that no one else seemed to be asking at the time. So no, we don't. I mean, we've gone reasonably high. We have our own podcast now, Page 94, hosted by Andrew Hunter Murray, which comes out every so often. And we've done things where the technology works. So Richard Brooks, who is our kind of big tax and finance investigative journalist, put together this amazing map a few years ago, an interactive map, so you can actually see which areas of Britain are held offshore, through which I discovered that on the other side of the fence, on the other side of my garden, is actually the British Virgin Islands, which is amazing.
So I'm discovering something similar. Our local shopping centre is, somewhere.
Yeah.
Much sunnier. But finally, then, we hurl into the last decade, then. This is, I don't even know what we call these, the 2010s. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. And actually, this last decade, Adam, wasn't particularly happy at all politically. Well, we had the coalition, then we had the Scottish referendum, the Brexit referendum, a general election every sort of 5 minutes. Never mind, Donald Trump and all of that. I mean, almost too much stuff for Private Eye, but actually it's just led to a sort of boom in circulation.
I do remember the issue directly after the referendum, where literally, I mean, we usually have a couple of editorial meetings a week and talk about what we're going to cover. And at that point, we were having to have several every day because it felt like every time you said, right, we're doing this. And then you come out of the meeting and you go, hang on, Boris has pulled out of the leadership. Oh, hang on, Farage has resigned as leader of UKIP. And I always remember, it just seemed like every day someone was pulling out, someone was resigning, someone was going. I mean, it started off with Prime Minister resigning at the beginning of the week. That was sort of old news by the time we came out a bit later. And I always remember that right up until the last minute, it was sort of 5 o'clock on a Monday when we were going to press. We thought, right, finally, we've got to knock this on the head. It's all over. At that point, Chris Evans resigned as presenter of Top Gear. And it was like, oh, come on! News just stop for a second. No, it has been quite mad. But that does, I mean, sort of, the sad thing is the bad times for the country do tend to mean good times for Private Eye. You can literally plot the circulation and it shoots up at times of war or chaos or Donald Trump. So I think it's the time where people desperately need a laugh, don't they? And also to feel informed about what's going on, which hopefully is the two unique things that Private Eye can provide.
So having read every single edition of Private Eye right back from 1961, is there a favourite bit, joke, feature that you've sort of really enjoyed revisiting in all that time?
Do you know, the one that I was really pleased to go back and revisit and feature in this book, because it never, I mean, a lot of things like Dear Bill and Mrs. Wilson's Diary and The Vicar of St. Albion's, which was our Tony Blair spoof, we did Private Eye produced books of, and they were kind of really, really celebrated. The one that was really nice to go back to is Heathcote, which was our prime ministerial parody of Ted Heath, who's running this sort of widget company, which is just falling apart, and strikes everywhere. People, workers demanding new pay rises. The lights keep going out. Nothing works properly. It's just 70s Britain in a nutshell. It's perfectly encapsulated. And he's constantly having problems with the automatic beaker dispensing unit in the works canteen because pieces are, some of the bits are imperial, some of the bits are metric, and it just keeps exploding and nothing working properly. It just captures that era of kind of British Leyland and endless strikes and the three-day week perfectly. So that was a real pleasure to go back and revisit. And to be honest, the Dear Bill letters as well, they are just a work of genius. That Richard Ingrams and John Wells wrote those, and they are just always a pleasure to go. I mean, even if you don't follow absolutely every in and out of the politics of whatever fortnight it was, just the characters within it. I mean, Boris, the KGB spy who's secretly working in Downing Street. It's fantastic stuff.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.